Once more, he related the similarities between Ben's story and Eddie's and tied those to what he had seen in the picture that moved. He suggested again that the clown had murdered the boys and girls who had been found dead in Derry since the previous December. And Mama Habe, not just for them, Bill finished. Well, what about all the ones who disappeared? Well, what about Eddie Corcoran? Shit, his stepfather scared him off, Richie said. Well, maybe he did, and maybe he didn't, Bill said. I knew him a little bit, too, and I know his dad beat him. And I also know he used to stay out in the heights sometimes to get away from him. So maybe the clown got him while he was staying away, Richie said thoughtfully. Is that it? Bill nodded. What do you want, then? Its autograph? If the hound killed the others, then he killed Georgie, Bill said. His eyes caught Richie's. They were like slate, hard, uncompromising, unforgiving. I will want to kill it. Jesus Christ, Richie said, frightened. How are you going to do that? Well, the dad's got a pistol, Bill said. A little spittle flew from his lips, but Richie barely noticed. He doesn't know I know, but I do. It's on the top shelf in his closet. That's great if it's a man, Richie said, and if we can find him sitting on a pile of kids' bones. I poured the tea, boys, Richie's mom called cheerily. Better come and get it. Right there, Mom, Richie called again, offering a big false smile. It disappeared immediately as he turned back to Bill. Because I wouldn't shoot a guy just because he was wearing a clown suit, Billy. You're my best friend, but I wouldn't do it, and I wouldn't let you do it if I could stop you. Well, what if there really was a pile of bones? Richie licked his lips and said nothing for a moment. Then he asked Bill, What are you going to do if it's not a man, Billy? What if it really is some kind of monster? What if there really are such things? Ben Hanscom said it was the mummy, and the balloons were floating against the wind, and it didn't cast a shadow. The picture in Georgie's album, either we imagined that or it was magic. And I gotta tell you, man, I don't think we just imagined it. Your fingers sure didn't imagine it, did they? Bill shook his head. So what are we going to do if it's not a man, Billy? Then we'll have to figure something else out. Oh, yeah, Richie said. I can see it. After you shoot it four or five times and it keeps coming at us like the teenage werewolf in that movie me and Ben and Bev saw, you can try your bullseye on it. And if the bullseye doesn't work, I'll throw some of my sneezing powder at it. And if it keeps on coming after that, we'll just call time and say, Hey now, hold on. This ain't getting it, Mr. Monster. Look, I got to read up on it at the library. I'll be back. Pardon me. Is that what you're going to say, Big Bill? He looked at his friend, his head thudding rapidly. Part of him wanted Bill to press on with his idea to check under the porch of that old house, but another part wanted, desperately wanted, Bill to give the idea up. In some ways, all of this was like having stepped into one of those Saturday afternoon horror movies at the Aladdin. But in another way, a crucial way, it wasn't like that at all. Because this wasn't safe like a movie, where you knew everything would turn out all right, and even if it didn't, it was no skin off your ass. The picture in Georgie's room hadn't been a movie. He had thought he was forgetting that, but apparently he had been fooling himself, because now he could see those cuts whirling up Billy's fingers. If he hadn't pulled Bill back. Incredibly, Bill was grinning. Actually grinning. You wanted me to take you to look at a picture, he said. Now, I wanted to take you to look at a house. Tit for tat. You've got no tits, Richie said, and they both burst out laughing. Tomorrow morning, Bill said, as if it had been resolved. And if it's a monster? Richie asked, holding Bill's eyes. If your dad's gun doesn't stop it, Big Bill, if it just keeps coming? We'll think of something else, Bill said again. We'll have to. He threw back his head and laughed like a loon. After a moment, Richie joined him. It was impossible not to. They walked up the crazy paving to Richie's porch together. Maggie had set out huge glasses of iced tea with mint sprigs in them and a plate of vanilla wafers. You will want to? Well, no, Richie said, but I will. Bill clapped him on the back, hard, and that seemed to make the fear bearable, although Richie was suddenly sure, and he was not wrong, that sleep would be long coming that night. You boys looked like you were having a serious discussion out there, Mrs. Tozier said, sitting down with her book in one hand and a glass of iced tea in the other. She looked at the boys expectantly. Oh, Denbro's got this crazy idea the Red Sox are going to finish in the first division, Richie said. Mamian might dad to think that they got a shot at the third, Bill said, and sipped his iced tea. This is Mrs. Tozier. Thank you, Bill. The year the Sox finish in the first division will be the year you stop stuttering, Mushmouth, Richie said. Richie, Mrs. Tozier screamed, shocked. She nearly dropped her glass of iced tea, but both Richie and Bill Denbro were laughing hysterically, totally cracked up. She looked from her son to Bill and back to her son again, touched by wonder that was mostly simple perplexity, but partly a fear so thin and sharp that it found its way deep into her inner heart and vibrated there like a tuning fork made of clear ice. I don't understand either of them, she thought. Where they go, what they do, what they want, or what will become of them. Sometimes, oh, sometimes their eyes are wild, and sometimes I'm afraid for them, and sometimes I'm afraid of them. She found herself thinking, not for the first time, that it would have been nice if she and Went could have had a girl as well, a pretty blonde girl that she could have dressed in skirts and matching bows and black patent leather shoes on Sundays, a pretty little girl who would ask to bake cupcakes after school, and who would want dolls instead of books on ventriloquism and Ravel models of cars that went fast. A pretty little girl she could have understood. 12. Did you get it? Richie asked anxiously. They were walking their bikes up Kansas Street beside the Barrens at 10 o'clock the next morning. The sky was a dull gray. Rain had been forecast for that afternoon. Richie hadn't gotten to sleep until after midnight, and he thought Denbro looked as if he had spent a fairly restless night himself. Old Big Bill was toting a matched set of Samsonite bags, one under each eye. I got it, Bill said. He patted the green duffel coat he was wearing. Let me see, Richie said, fascinated. Not now, Bill said, and then grinned. Someone else might see, too. But look what else I brought. He reached behind him, under the coat, and brought his bullseye slingshot out of his back pocket. Oh, shit, we're in trouble, Richie said, beginning to laugh. Bill pretended to be hurt. It was your idea, Tozier. Bill had gotten a custom aluminum slingshot for his birthday the year before. It had been Zach's compromise between the 22 Bill had wanted and his mother's adamant refusal to even consider giving a boy Bill's age a firearm. The instruction booklet said a slingshot could be a fine hunting weapon once you learn to use it. In the right hands, your bullseye slingshot is as deadly and effective as a good ash bow or a high-powered firearm, the booklet proclaimed. With such virtues dutifully extolled, the booklet went on to warn that a slingshot could be dangerous. The owner should no more aim one of the 20 ball-bearing slugs which came with it at a person than he would aim a loaded pistol at a person. Bill wasn't very good at it yet, and guessed privately he probably never would be, but he thought the booklet's caution was merited. The slingshot's thick elastic had a hard pull, and when you hit a tin can with it, it made one hell of a hole. You doing any better with it, Big Bill? Richie asked. A little, Bill said. That was only partly true. After much study of the pictures in the booklet, which were labeled figs, as in fig one, fig two, and so on, and enough practice in Dairy Park to lame his arm, he had gotten so he could hit the paper target, which had also come with the slingshot, maybe 3 times out of every 10 tries. And once he had gotten the bullseye. Almost. Richie pulled the sling back by the cup, twanged it, then handed it back. He said nothing, but privately doubted if it would count for as much as Zach Denbro's pistol when it came to killing monsters. Yeah, he said. You brought your slingshot. Okay, big deal. That's nothing. Look what I brought, Denbro. And from his own jacket, he hauled out a packet with a cartoon picture on it of a bald man saying, Achoo, as his cheeks puffed out like Dizzy Gillespie's. Dr. Wacky Sneezing Powder, the packet said. It's a laugh riot. The two of them stared at each other for a long moment and then broke up, screaming with laughter and pounding each other on the back. Well, we're prepared for anything, Bill said finally, still giggling and wiping his eyes with the sleeve of his jacket. Your face in my ass, stuttering Bill, Richie said. I thought it was the other way around, Bill said. Now listen, we're gonna hash your bike down in the Barrens. Where I put Silver when we play. You ride at a double behind me in case where we have to make a quick getaway. Richie nodded, feeling no urge to argue. His 22-inch Raleigh, he sometimes whammed his kneecaps on the handlebars when he was pedaling fast, looked like a pygmy bike next to the scrawny, gantry-like edifice that was Silver. He knew that Bill was stronger and Silver was faster. They got to the little bridge, and Bill helped Richie stow his bike underneath. Then they sat down, and with the occasional rumble of traffic passing over their heads, Bill unzipped his duffel and took out his father's pistol. You be goddamn careful, Bill said, handing it over after Richie had whistled his frank approval. There's no safety on a pistol like that. Is it loaded? Richie asked, awed. The pistol, a PPK Walther that Zach Denbro picked up during the occupation, seemed unbelievably heavy. Not yet, Bill said. He patted his pocket. I got some bullets in here. But my dad says sometimes you look and then, if the gun thinks you're not being careful, it loads it itself. So it can shoot you. His face uttered a strange smile, which said that, while he didn't believe anything so silly, he believed it completely. Richie understood. There was a caged deadliness in the thing that he had never sensed in his dad's 22, 30-30, or even the shotgun. Although there was something about the shotgun, wasn't there? Something about the way it leaned, mute and oily, in the corner of the garage closet, as if it might say, I could be mean if I wanted to. Plenty mean, you bet, if it could speak. But this pistol, this Walther, it was as if it had been made for the express purpose of shooting people. With a chill, Richie realized that was why it had been made. What else could you do with the pistol? Use it to light your cigarettes? He turned the muzzle toward him, being careful to keep his hands far away from the trigger. One look into the Walther's black, lidless eye made him understand Bill's peculiar smile perfectly. He remembered his father saying, If you remember, there is no such thing as an unloaded gun. You'll be okay with firearms all your life, Richie. He handed the gun back to Bill, glad to be rid of it. Bill stowed it in his duffel coat again. Suddenly, the house on Niebold Street seemed less frightening to Richie. But the possibility that blood might actually be spilled, that seemed much stronger. He looked at Bill, perhaps meaning to appeal this idea again, but he saw Bill's face, read it, and only said, You ready? 13. As always, when Bill finally pulled his second foot up from the ground, Richie felt sure that they would crash, splitting their silly skulls on unyielding cement. The big bike wavered crazily from side to side. The cards clothespinned to the fender struts stopped firing single shots and started machine gunning. The bike's drunken wavers became more pronounced. Richie closed his eyes and waited for the inevitable. Then Bill bellowed, Hi-yo, Silver! Away! The bike picked up more speed and finally stopped that seasick side-to-side wavering. Richie loosened his death grip on Bill's middle and held the front of the package carrier over the rear wheel instead. Bill crossed Kansas Street on a slant, raced down side streets at an ever-quickening pace, heading for Wycheham as if racing down a set of geographical steps. They came bulleting out of Strapham Street and onto Wycheham at an exorbitant rate of speed. Bill laid Silver damn near over on his side and bellowed, Hi-yo, Silver, again. Ride it, Big Bill, Richie screamed, so scared he was nearly creaming his jeans, but laughing wildly all the same. Stand on this, baby. Bill suited the action to the word, getting up and leaning over the handlebars and pumping the pedals at a lunatic rate. Looking at Bill's back, which was amazingly broad for a boy of 11 going on 12, watching it work under the duffel coat, the shoulders slanting first one way and then the other as he shifted his weight from one pedal to the other, Richie suddenly became sure that they were invulnerable. They would live forever and ever. Well, perhaps not they, but Bill would. Bill had no idea of how strong he was, how somehow sure and perfect. They sped along, the houses thinning out a little now, the streets crossing which him at longer intervals. "Hi-yo, Silver!" Bill yelled, and Richie hollered in his nigger Jim voice, high and shrill, "Hi-yo, Silver, massa, that's right. You is riding this year bike for show, locks a mussy. Hi-yo, Silver, away!" Now they were passing green fields that looked flat and depthless under the gray sky. Richie could see the old brick train station up ahead in the distance. To the right of it, Quonset warehouses marched off in a row. Silver bumped over one set of train tracks, then another. And here was Niebolt Street, cutting off to the right. Berry Train Yards, a blue sign under the street sign, read. It was rusty and hung askew. Below this was a much bigger sign, yellow field, black letters. It was almost like a comment on the train yards themselves. Dead end, it read. Bill turned onto Niebolt Street, coasted to the sidewalk, and put his foot back down. Let's walk from here. Richie slipped off the package carrier with mingled feelings of relief and regret. Okay. They walked along the sidewalk, which was cracked and weedy. Up ahead of them, in the train yards, a diesel engine revved slowly up, faded off, and then began all over again. Once or twice they heard the metallic music of couplings being smashed together. You scared? Richie asked Bill. Bill, walking Silver by the handlebars, looked over at Richie briefly and then nodded. Yeah, you? I sure am, Richie said. Bill told Richie he had asked his father about Niebolt Street the night before. His father said that a lot of train men had lived out this way until the end of World War II. Engineers, conductors, signalmen, yard workers, baggage handlers. The street had declined with the train yards, and as Bill and Richie moved farther along it, the houses became farther apart, seedier, dirtier. The last three or four on both sides were empty and boarded up, their yards overgrown. A for sale sign flapped forlornly from the porch of one. To Richie, the sign looked about 1,000 years old. The sidewalk stopped, and now they were walking along a beaten track from which weeds grew half-heartedly. Bill stopped and pointed. There it is, he said softly. 29 Niebolt Street had once been a trim red Cape Cod. Maybe, Richie thought, an engineer used to live there, a bachelor with no pants but jeans and lots of those gloves with the big stiff cuffs and four or five pillow-tick caps, a fellow who would come home once or twice a month for stretches of 3 or 4 days and listen to the radio while he pottered in the garden, a fellow who would eat mostly fried foods and no vegetables, although he would grow them for his friends, and who would, on windy nights, think about the girl he left behind. Now the red paint had faded to a wishy-washy pink that was peeling away in ugly patches that looked like sores. The windows were blind eyes, boarded up. Most of the shingles were gone. Weeds grew rankly down both sides of the house, and the lawn was covered with the season's first bumper crop of dandelions. To the left, a high board fence, perhaps once a neat white but now faded to a dull gray that almost matched the lowering sky, lurched drunkenly in and out of the dank shrubbery. About halfway down this fence, Richie could see a monstrous grove of sunflowers. The tallest looked 5 feet tall or more. They had a bloated, nasty look he didn't like. A breeze rustled them, and they seemed to nod together. The boys are here. Isn't that nice? More boys. Our boys. Richie shivered. While Bill leaned Silver carefully against an elm, Richie surveyed the house. He saw a wheel sticking out of the thick grass near the porch and pointed it out to Bill. Bill nodded. It was the overturned trike Eddie had mentioned. They looked up and down Niebolt Street. The chug of the diesel engine rose and fell off, then began again. The sound seemed to hang in the overcast like a charm. The street was utterly deserted. Richie could hear occasional cars passing on Route 2, but could not see them. The diesel engine chugged and faded, chugged and faded. The huge sunflowers nodded sagely together. Fresh boys, good boys, our boys. You ready? Bill asked, and Richie jumped a little. You know, I was just thinking that maybe the last bunch of library books I took out are due today, Richie said. Maybe I ought to cut the crap, River Richie. Are you ready or not? I guess I am, Richie said, knowing he was not ready at all. He was never going to be ready for this scene. They crossed the overgrown lawn to the porch. Look there, Bill said. At the far left-hand side, the porch's latticework skirt leaned out against a tangle of bushes. Both boys could see the rusty nails that had been pulled free. There were old rose bushes here, and while the roses both to the right and the left of the unanchored stretch of latticework were blooming in a lackadaisical way, those directly around and in front of it were skeletal and dead. Bill and Richie looked at each other grimly. Everything Eddie said seemed true enough. 7 weeks later, the evidence was still here. You don't really want to go under there, do you? Richie asked. He was almost pleading.
No, Bill said.
But I'm gonna. And with a sinking heart, Richie saw that he absolutely meant it. That gray light was back in Billy's eyes, shining steadily. There was a stony eagerness in the lines of his face that made him look older. Richie thought, I think he really does mean to kill it, if it's still there. Kill it and maybe cut off its head and take it to his father and say, Look, this is what killed Georgie. Now will you talk to me again at night? Maybe just tell me how your day was or who lost when you guys were flipping to see who paid for the morning coffee?
Bill, he said.
But Bill was no longer there. He was walking around to the right-hand end of the porch, where Eddie must have crawled under. Richie had to chase after him, and he almost fell over the trike caught in the weeds and slowly rusting its way into the ground. He caught up as Bill squatted, looking under the porch. There was no skirt at all on this end. Someone, some hobo, had pried it off long ago to gain access to the shelter underneath, out of the January snow or the cold November rain or a summer thundershower. Richie squatted beside him, his heart thudding like a drum. There was nothing under the porch but drifts of moldering leaves, yellowing newspapers and shadows. Too many shadows.
Bill, he repeated.
What? Bill had produced his father's Walther again. He pulled the clip carefully from the grip and then took 4 bullets from his pants pocket. He loaded them in one at a time. Richie watched this, fascinated, and then looked under the porch again. He saw something else this time. Broken glass. Faintly glinting shards of glass. His stomach cramped painfully. He was not a stupid boy, and he understood this came close to completely confirming Eddie's story. Splinters of glass on the moldering leaves under the porch meant that the window had been broken from inside, from the cellar.
Well, what?
Bill asked again, looking up at Richie. His face was grim and white. Looking at that set face, Richie mentally threw in the towel.
Nothing, he said.
You cook a hunting?
Yeah.
They crawled under the porch. The smell of decaying leaves was a smell Richie usually liked, but there was nothing pleasant about the smell under here. The leaves felt spongy under his hands and knees, and he had an impression that they might go down for 2 or 3 feet. He suddenly wondered what he would do if a hand or a claw sprang out of those leaves and seized him. Bill was examining the broken window. Glass had sprayed everywhere. The wooden strip which had been between the panes lay in 2 splintered pieces under the porch steps. The top of the window frame jutted out like a broken bone.
Something hit that fucker wicked hard, Richie breathed.
Bill, now peering inside, or trying to, nodded. Richie elbowed him aside enough so he could look too. The basement was a dim litter of crates and boxes. The floor was earth and, like the leaves, it gave off a damp and humid aroma. A furnace bulked to the left, thrusting round pipes at the low ceiling. Beyond it, at the end of the cellar, Richie could see a large stall with wooden sides. A horse stall was his first thought, but who kept horses in the Geesley cellar? Then he realized that in a house as old as this one, the furnace must have burned coal instead of oil. Nobody had bothered to convert the furnace because no one wanted the house. That thing with the sides was a coal bin. To the far right, Richie could make out a flight of stairs going up to ground level. Now Bill was sitting down, hunching himself forward, and before Richie could actually believe what he was up to, his friend's legs were disappearing into the window.
Bill, Christ's sake, he hissed. What are you doing? Get out of there.
Bill didn't reply. He slithered through, scraping his duffel coat up from the small of his back, barely missing a chunk of glass that would have cut him a good one. A second later, Richie heard his tennies smack down on the earth hard inside.
Piss on this action, Richie muttered frantically to himself,
looking at the square of darkness into which his friend had disappeared.
Bill, you gone out of your mind?
Bill's voice floated up.
You cook again, stay up the there if you will want, River Richie. Stand guard.
Instead, he rolled over on his belly and shoved his legs through the cellar window before his nerve could go bad on him, hoping he wouldn't cut his hands or his stomach on the broken glass. Something clutched his legs. Richie screamed.
It's just me, Bill hissed.
And a moment later, Richie was standing beside him in the cellar, pulling down his shirt and his jacket.
Who did you think it was?
The boogeyman, Richie said, and laughed shakily.
You go that way, and I'll go fuck that, Richie said.
He could actually hear his heartbeat in his voice, making it sound bumpy and uneven, first up and then down.
I'm sticking with you, Big Bill.
They moved toward the coal pit first, Bill slightly in the lead, the gun in his hand, Richie close behind him, trying to look everywhere at once. Bill stood beyond one of the coal pit's jutting wooden sides for a moment, and then suddenly darted around it, pointing the gun with both hands. Richie squinched his eyes shut, steeling himself for the explosion. It didn't come. He opened his eyes again cautiously.
Nothing but coal,
Bill said and giggled nervously. Richie stepped up beside Bill and looked. There was still a drift of old coal in here, piled up almost to the ceiling at the back of the stall and trickling away to a lump or two by their feet. It was as black as a crow's wing.
Let's,
Richie began, and then the door at the head of the cellar stairs crashed open against the wall with a violent bang, spilling thin white daylight down the stairs. Both boys screamed. Richie heard snarling sounds. They were very loud, the sounds a wild animal in a cage might make. He saw loafers descend the steps, faded jeans on top of them, swinging hands. But they weren't hands. They were paws. Huge, misshapen paws.
Climb the coal,
Bill was screaming. But Richie stood frozen, suddenly knowing what was coming for them. What was going to kill them in this cellar that stank of damp earth and the cheap wine that had been spilled in the corners. Knowing but needing to see.
There's a window at the top of the coal.
The paws were covered with dense brown hair that curled and coiled like wire. The fingers were tipped with jagged nails. Now Richie saw a silk jacket. It was black with orange piping. The Derry High School colors.
Go,
Bill screamed and gave Richie a gigantic shove. Richie went sprawling into the coal. Sharp jags and corners of it poked him painfully, breaking through his daze. More coal avalanched over his hands. That mad snarling went on and on. Panic slipped its hood over Richie's mind. Barely aware of what he was doing, he scrambled up the mountain of coal, gaining ground, sliding back, lunging upward again, screaming as he went. The window at the top was grimed black with coal dust and let in next to no light at all. It was latched shut. Richie seized the latch, which was of the sort that turned, and threw all his weight against it. The latch moved not at all. The snarling was closer now. The gun went off below him, the sound nearly deafening in the closed room. Gun smoke, sharp and acrid, stung Richie's nose. It shocked him back to some sort of awareness, and he realized that he had been trying to turn the thumb latch the wrong way. He reversed the direction of the force he was applying, and the latch gave with a protracted, rusty squeal. Coal dust sifted down on his hands like pepper. The gun went off again with a second deafening bang. Bill Denbro shouted, "You killed my brother, you fucker!" For a moment, the creature which had come down the stairs seemed to laugh, seemed to speak. It was as if a vicious dog had suddenly begun to bark out garbled words, and for a moment Richie thought the thing in the high school jacket snarled back,
"I'm going to kill you, too."
"Richie!" Bill screamed then, and Richie heard coal clattering and falling again as Bill scrambled up. The snarls and roars continued, wood splintered, there were mingled barks and howls, sounds out of a cold nightmare. Richie gave the window a tremendous shove, not caring if the glass broke and cut his hands to ribbons. He was beyond caring. It did not break. It swung outward on an old steel hinge flaked with rust. More coal dust sifted down, this time on Richie's face. He wriggled out into the side yard like an eel, smelling sweet, fresh air, feeling the long grass whip at his face. He was dimly aware that it was raining. He could see the thick stalks of the giant sunflowers, green and hairy. The Walther went off a third time, and the beast in the cellar screamed, a primitive sound of pure rage. Then Bill cried,
"It's got me, Richie! Help! It's got me!"
Richie turned around on his hands and knees and saw the terrified circle of his friend's upturned face in the square of the oversized cellar window through which a winter's load of coal had once been funneled each October. Bill was lying spread-eagled on the coal. His hands waved and clutched fruitlessly for the window frame, which was just out of reach. His shirt and jacket were rucked up almost to his breastbone, and he was sliding backward. No, he was being pulled backward by something Richie could barely see. It was a moving, bulking shadow behind Bill, a shadow that snarled and gibbered and sounded almost human. Richie didn't need to see it. He had seen it the previous Saturday on the screen of the Aladdin Theater. It was mad, totally mad. But even so, it never occurred to Richie to doubt either his own sanity or his conclusion. The teenage werewolf had Bill Denbro. Only it wasn't that guy Michael Landon with a lot of makeup on his face and a lot of fake fur. It was real. As if to prove it, Bill screamed again. Richie reached in and caught Bill's hands in his own. The Walther pistol was in one of them, and for the second time that day, Richie looked into its black eye. Only this time it was loaded. They tussled for Bill, Richie gripping his hands, the werewolf gripping his ankles.
Get out of here, Richie, Bill screamed. Get.
The face of the werewolf suddenly swam out of the dark. Its forehead was low and prognathous, covered with scant hair. Its cheeks were hollow and furry. Its eyes were a dark brown, filled with horrible intelligence, horrible awareness. Its mouth dropped open, and it began to snarl. White foam ran from the corners of its thick lower lip in twin streams that dripped from its chin. The hair on its head was swept back in a gruesome parody of a teenager's DA. It threw its head back and roared, its eyes never leaving Richie's. Bill scrambled up the coal. Richie seized his forearms and pulled. For a moment, he thought he was actually going to win. Then the werewolf laid hold of Bill's legs again, and he was yanked backward toward the darkness once more. It was stronger. It had laid hold of Bill, and it meant to have him. Then, with no thought at all about what he was doing or why he was doing it, Richie heard the voice of the Irish cop coming out of his mouth, Mr. Nell's voice. But this was not Richie Tozier doing a bad imitation. It wasn't even precisely Mr. Nell. It was the voice of every Irish beat cop that had ever lived and twirled a billy by its rawhide rope as he tried the doors of closed shops after midnight.
Let go of him, boyo, or I'll crack your thick head. I swear to Jesus. Leave go of him now, or I'll serve ye your own arse on a platter.
The creature in the cellar let out an ear-splitting roar of rage, but it seemed to Richie that there was another note in that bellow as well. Perhaps fear or pain. He gave one more tremendous tug, and Bill flew out of the window and onto the grass. He stared up at Richie with dark, horrified eyes. The front of his jacket was smeared black with coal dust.
Quick, Bill panted.
He was nearly moaning. He grabbed at Richie's shirt.
Woo-wee-ga-ga-hada.
Richie could hear coal tumbling and avalanching down again. A moment later, the werewolf's face filled the cellar window. It snarled at them, its paws clutched at the listless grass. Bill still had the Walther. He had held on to the gun through all of it. Now he held it out in both hands, his eyes squinched down to slits, and pulled the trigger. There was another deafening bang. Richie saw a chunk of the werewolf's skull tear free, and a torrent of blood spilled down the side of its face, matting the fur there and soaking the collar of the school jacket it wore. Roaring, it began to climb out of the window. Moving slowly, dreamily, Richie reached under his coat and into his back pocket. He brought out the envelope with the picture of the sneezing man on it. He tore it open as the bleeding, roaring creature pulled itself out of the window, forcing its way, claws digging deep furrows in the earth. Richie tore the packet open and squeezed it.
Get back in your place, boyo,
he ordered in the voice of the Irish cop. A white cloud puffed into the werewolf's face. Its roars suddenly stopped. It stared at Richie with almost comic surprise and made a choked wheezing sound. Its eyes, red and bleary, rolled toward Richie and seemed to mark him once and forever. Then it began to sneeze. It sneezed again and again and again. Ropey strings of saliva flew from its muzzle. Greenish-black clots of snot flew out of its nostrils. One of these splattered against Richie's skin and burned there, like acid. He wiped it away with a scream of hurt and disgust. There was still anger in its face, but there was also pain. It was unmistakable. Bill might have heard it with his dad's pistol, but Richie had heard it more, first with the voice of the Irish cop, and then with the sneezing powder.
Jesus, if I had some itching powder, too, and maybe a joy buzzer, I might be able to kill it, Richie thought.
And then Bill grabbed the collar of his jacket and jerked him backward. It was well that he did. The werewolf stopped sneezing as suddenly as it had started and lunged at Richie. It was quick, too, incredibly quick. Richie might have only sat there with the empty envelope of Dr. Wacky's sneezing powder in one hand, staring at the werewolf with a kind of drugged wonder, thinking how brown its fur was, how red the blood was, how nothing was in black and white in real life. He might have sat there until its paws closed around his neck and its long nails pulled his throat out, but Bill grabbed him again and pulled him to his feet. Richie stumbled after him. They ran around to the front of the house, and Richie thought, "It won't dare chase us anymore. We're on the street now. It won't dare chase us. Won't dare, won't dare." But it was coming. He could hear it just behind them, gibbering and snarling and slobbering. There was Silver, still leaning against the tree. Bill jumped onto the seat and threw his father's pistol into the carrier basket where they had carried so many play guns. Richie chanced a glance behind him as he flung himself onto the package carrier and saw the werewolf crossing the lawn toward them, less than 20 feet away now. Blood and slobber mixed on its high school jacket. White bone gleamed through its pelt about the right temple. There were white smudges of sneezing powder on the sides of its nose. And Richie saw two other things which seemed to complete the horror. There was no zipper on the thing's jacket. Instead, there were big, fluffy orange buttons like pom-poms. The other thing was worse. It was the other thing that made him feel as if he might faint or just give up and let it kill him. A name was stitched on the jacket in gold thread, the kind of thing you could get down at Machen's for a buck if you wanted it. Stitched on the bloody left breast of the werewolf's jacket, stained but readable, were the words, "Richie Tozier." It lunged at them. "Go, Bill!" Richie screamed. Silver began to move, but slowly, much too slowly. It took Bill so long to get going. The werewolf crossed the rutted path just as Bill pedaled into the middle of Nebolt Street. Blood splattered its faded jeans, and looking back over his shoulder, filled with a kind of dreadful, unbreakable fascination that was akin to hypnosis, Richie saw that the seams of the jeans were giving way in places, and tufts of coarse brown fur had sprung through. Silver wavered wildly back and forth. Bill was standing up, gripping the bike's handlebars from underneath, head turned up toward the cloudy sky, cords standing out on his neck. And still the playing cards were only firing single shots. One paw groped for Richie. He screamed miserably and ducked away from it. The werewolf snarled and grinned. It was close enough so Richie could see the yellowing corneas of its eyes, could smell sweet rotten meat on its breath. Its teeth were crooked fangs. Richie screamed again as it swung a paw at him. He was sure it was going to take his head off, but the paw passed in front of him, missing by no more than an inch. The force of the swing blew Richie's sweaty hair back from his forehead. "Hey, Silver, away!" Bill screamed at the top of his voice. He had reached the top of a short, shallow hill. Not much, but enough to get Silver rolling. The playing cards picked up speed and began to burr along. Bill pumped the pedals madly. Silver stopped wavering and cut a straight course down Nebolt Street toward Route 2. "Thank God, thank God, thank God," Richie thought incoherently. "Thank..." The werewolf roared again. "Oh my God, it sounds like it's right beside me." And Richie's wind was cut off as his shirt and jacket were jerked back against his windpipe. He made a gargling, choking sound and managed to grip Bill's middle just before he was pulled off the back of the bike. Bill tilted backward but held on to Silver's handlebar grips. For one moment, Richie thought the big bike would simply do a wheelie and spill both of them off the back. Then his jacket, which had been just about ready for the rag bag anyway, parted down the back with a loud ripping noise that sounded weirdly like a big fart. Richie could breathe again. He looked around and stared directly into those muddy, murderous eyes. "Bill!" he tried to howl it, but the word had no force, no sound. Bill seemed to hear him anyway. He pedaled even harder, harder than he ever had in his life. All his guts seemed to be rising, coming unanchored. He could taste thick, coppery blood in the back of his throat. His eyeballs were starting from their sockets. His mouth hung open, scooping air. And a crazy, ineluctable sense of exhilaration filled him, something that was wild and free and all his own. A desire. He stood on the pedals, coaxed them, battered them. Silver continued to pick up speed. He was beginning to feel the road now, beginning to fly. Bill could feel him go. "Hi-yo, Silver!" he screamed again. "Hi-yo, Silver! Away!" Richie could hear the fast rattle thud of loafers on the macadam. He turned. The werewolf's paw struck him above the eyes with stunning force. And for a moment, Richie really did think the top of his head had come off. Things suddenly seemed dim, unimportant. Sounds faded in and out. The color washed out of the world. He turned back, clinging desperately to Bill. Warm blood ran into his right eye, stinging. The paw swung again, striking the back fender this time. Richie felt the bike waver crazily, for a moment on the verge of tipping over, finally straightening out again. Bill yelled, "Hi-o, Silver, away!" again. But that was distant, too, like an echo heard just before it dies out. Richie closed his eyes and held onto Bill and waited for the end. 14. Bill had also heard the running steps and understood that the clown hadn't given up yet, but he didn't dare turn around and look. He would know if it caught up and knocked them flat. That was really all he needed to know. "Come on, boy," he thought. "Give me everything now, everything you got. Go, Silver, go." So once again, Bill Dendro found himself racing to beat the devil. Only now the devil was a hideously grinning clown whose face sweated white grease paint, whose mouth curved up in a leering red vampire smile, whose eyes were bright silver coins. A clown who was, for some lunatic reason, wearing a Derry High School jacket over its silvery suit with the orange ruff and the orange pom-pom buttons. "Go, boy, go! Silver, what do you say?" Kneebolt Street blurred by him now. Silver was starting to hum good now. Had those running footfalls faded back a bit? He still didn't dare turn around to see. Richie had him in a death grip. He was pinching off his wind, and Bill wanted to tell Richie to loosen up a little, but he didn't dare waste breath on that either. There, up ahead, like a beautiful dream, was the stop sign marking the intersection of Kneebolt Street and Route 2. Cars were passing back and forth on Witcham. In his state of exhausted terror, this seemed somehow like a miracle to Bill. Now, because he would have to put on his brakes in a moment or do something really inventive, he risked a look back over his shoulder. What he saw caused him to reverse Silver's pedal with a single snap jerk. Silver skidded, laying rubber with its locked rear tire, and Richie's head smacked painfully into the hollow of Bill's right shoulder. The street was completely empty. But 25 yards or so behind them, by the first of the abandoned houses which formed a kind of funeral cortege leading up to the train yards, there was a bright flick of orange. It lay close to a storm drain cut into the curbing. Almost too late, Bill realized that Richie was sliding off the back of Silver. Richie's eyes were turned up so Bill could only see the lower rims of the irises below his upper lids. The mended bow of his glasses hung askew. Blood was flowing slowly from his forehead. Bill grabbed his arm. They both slipped to the right, and Silver overbalanced. They crashed to the street in a tangle of arms and legs. Bill barked his crazy bone a good one and shouted with pain. Richie's eyes flickered at the sound.
"I am going to show you how to get to this treasure, Senhor. But this man Dobbs is plenty dangerous,"
Richie said in a snoring gasp. It was his Pancho Vanilla voice, but its floating, unconnected quality scared Bill badly. He saw several coarse brown hairs clinging to the shallow head wound on Richie's forehead. They were slightly kinky, like his father's pubic hair. They made him feel even more afraid, and he fetched Richie a strong smack upside the head. End of side 10.